नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय I didn't say anything. Hey, that's pretty good. Unfortunately, none of these are on the topic of what I'm going to talk about. This is from Bhagavad Gita. Nasato vidyate bhavo, na bhavo vidyate sattaha. Ubayor api jistonyas, tramanayos sattvadarshibhi. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance, and of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. So let's say you could go to some wonderful astrologer, fortune teller, and they said, 10 lifetimes ago, you were a great emperor. You conquered in all directions. You were fabulously wealthy. You had everything you wanted. And 3 lifetimes ago, you were a great scholar. You defeated everyone. And so on and so forth. What would you say?
What about now?
So what? So what? That's interesting. Oh, that's kind of cool. That's kind of neat. So what? If you could get a list of all of the accomplishments materially that you have done in the past 100 lives, you would look at it and say, yeah, so what good does that do me now? Now, if our material accomplishments don't matter to us, do you think they matter to anybody else? They're not even important to us. We don't even care. Think of what we did when we were little children. We made all these nice little drawings and we wrote little stories and we were so proud of them. Do you remember? Remember that? Bringing them home and showing your parents. And if you had really nice parents, which I hope you did, they said, oh, this is wonderful. Look how you drew the little ears over there. And what is that, an arrow? And you said, no, that's not an arrow, it's a tree. And they said, oh, it's a nice tree. And they put it up on the refrigerator. And maybe you even saved all these in boxes. Maybe you have a box somewhere with your stuff. You look through it. Is it very important? Do you still feel all excited about your little tree? Does it matter? Is there anything materially that's of any real value? The people built this building. How old is this building? 300? 300. 1 to 300. And we can see it's starting to fall apart, right? The stucco's coming off. It's an old building. It's an old building. You see the tiles are cracking. How long will this building stay here? Suppose you could build a building out of solid stone and it would last for 1,000 years. Then after 1,000 years, who cares? Anybody care? Anybody care? What happens to most of the books and the philosophy and scientific papers that people write? Does anybody read them? Where do they go? In the trash. Who cares? I mean, think of any material accomplishment. Does it really matter? No. And does it really bring us any satisfaction? I was asking the other day of all the things that we've wanted. And either we haven't gotten them, Or we got them and we were disappointed. Or we got them and we love them and we know we're going to lose them. Which means we're always in anxiety. So the things in this world have no ultimate meaning and they give no ultimate satisfaction. Now how's that for a depressing start to a class? So there you are. Most of you here, anyway, are young. For those of you who are old, sorry, this class is not for you. Maybe you'll get something out of it. But most of you are young, and you're thinking, I remember thinking, I was in a university, and my university had a work-study program. 2 months out of the year, you had to work. You had to have some kind of a job. It didn't have to be a paying job. And first, second year, it could be anything. Third, fourth year, it had to be in relationship to your studies. Anyway, I had a job at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. And I was already chanting, although I had not by any means made a commitment to join the Hare Krishna movement. Like Deva Mitraswami said, I didn't want to join any organization. But anyway, so I was riding on the train to work every day, and I was seeing all the people going to work, and they all looked like this. At 6 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, well, I was in university, I'm thinking, what am I going to do with my life? Naturally, you're thinking like that. I thought, whatever I do with my life, after 10 or 15 years, I'm going to also look like this. You know, I'll find some fascinating career, and it'll become boring. But I want to be able to wake up every day excited about what I'm doing. I want what I'm doing to have some real value to myself and to society. And I sat down with my friends, and I made a list of everything I could possibly do, and it was all useless. None of it. What is the use of any of this? So this is, of course, the platform again. When one comes to the platform of knowledge, one considers that everything in the world is useless. From the ultimate point of view, that is a fact. And people who stop at that level, either they become nihilists, they think everything is just void or impersonal, they want to merge with the Brahman, or they commit suicide, or indirectly commit suicide through intoxication or something like that. But here it says there is also something in which there is no change. There's something that doesn't end. There is something that is eternal. There is something that's meaningful. There is something that will bring satisfaction to ourselves and to others. There is something where you can say every morning, I want to be doing what I'm doing. And you can go to bed at night saying, I made some worthwhile contribution to myself and to others. And my mother recently died in the beginning of December. And I spent about 2.5 weeks by the kind mercy of Amul's parents. They facilitated me and put me up at their house and fed me and lent me a car, for goodness sake. So I could go take care of my mother, who was in a nursing home. And when you're in a nursing home, you see these people at the end of their life, and they have nothing. They have nothing. My mother was fabulously wealthy. My family were multimillionaires, very famous people, lived in fancy buildings. She never had to work for money, but she was in charge of many big charity organizations. She gave her whole life to religious charities. Very, very intelligent. She could remember anything she'd ever heard. Any date, anything. Incredible, incredible mind. Very beautiful. She was a beauty queen. She traveled all over the world after winning a beauty contest. She had many friends. Very influential person. She was according to modern Western standards, she was a pious person. She wasn't a particularly sinful person. But at the end of her life, what did she have? She had a little room, half a room, in a nursing home. She had her chair. She kept her chair. She had taken all her awards and certificates and put them on the wall. She had one painting. She had some photo albums. Just photo albums. Here's the marriage of this daughter, here's this grandchild, here's this great-grandchild, here's this accomplishment, here's me winning this award, here's me accomplishing this, here's me winning the beauty queen contest. That's all she had, a bunch of pictures. She had nothing substantial to take with her. And I was asking everybody, what do you do for someone at the end of life? And they said, I don't know. All the doctors, her religious leader comes in and says, hello, beautiful, how you doing? Are you going to get better soon? And here's this 89-year-old woman who hasn't eaten for 2 months. And she's just skin and bones. Oh, beautiful, you're going to get better. This was their guidance. And then the local psychologist, he was a geriatric psychologist. That means he gives counseling to old people. So he said, yes, I tell people death is a journey. I thought, oh, that's nice. So I tell them, think about where you want to go, and they want to go sailing or shopping. And I said to this man, well, they're actually going to go there. And he said, well, I'm not a very spiritual person, you know. And I was talking to the doctor, what about the spiritual side? And he said, oh, I don't want to hear philosophy. I said, what do you tell people at the end of life? Oh, have faith. Have faith in what? And I made friends with many of the elderly people there. And this one lady, when I would walk past, she would grab my arm. She wouldn't let me go. She said, I'm so lonely. She said, I miss my husband. I said, where's your husband? Oh, he's dead. I said, what did he do? And she's like, I can't remember. I said, well, what did you do? I can't remember. I said, did you have any children? I had three sons. No, I had two sons. I think it was three sons. I'm not sure. But I'm so lonely. So that's what it is. You can't even remember. At least my mother could remember. But many people, they can't even remember. What did I do? I don't know. What did you accomplish in your life? I don't remember. And even if you remember, what is it? It's just a photo album. One man, he told me, oh, I was a big chef in a fancy New York restaurant, one of the best restaurants in New York. I was the top chef. I said, it must be very hard for you here eating this old age home food. And he said, yes, it is very painful. Finish. But there is something you can have. There is something you can have. There's something you can have. There's something you can have. Where you will say, yes, at the end of life, you'll say, yes, I did something worthwhile. I have something. And that is what pertains to us. Krishna says of the soul, na jayate miyate va kadachid, nayam bhutva bhavita va anabhuyaha, ajo nitya sasvato yam purano, nahanyate hanyamane sharire. We are not born, we are not dying, we are not part of this world, we have nothing to do with this world. Our business should be to do something here that is permanent, that is meaningful. And you might say, well, what can I do? I'm just a little person. One little person, one little grain of sand on the beach. I have practically no talents, no intelligence, no energy, no money. I have some abilities, but what can I do? I'm not Srila Prabhupada. I'm not some George Harrison. What am I going to do? What can I really contribute? So one can look at it from two angles. First of all, there is quality. One person of quality, like we say, one moon, can light up the whole sky. If you become a person of spiritual quality, then even if you don't do much externally, you will influence so many people. So many people. We think about Lord Jesus Christ. He only preached in a very small area of the world for 3 years. Very small area of the world, to just a few people. He didn't travel everywhere. There was no television. There was no radio. There was no big printing press. He didn't even record his own words. And still, 2,000 years later, millions of people are being influenced by him, and many for good. We cannot, just because it is not at the highest principle, we cannot just dismiss it as useless. Still, 2,000 years later, just preaching in a small area to a few people, not even anything recorded, nothing. Why? Because of quality. But also, even a little bit may make a very big difference. There's one story, and I was thinking that I wished I had brought the video with me. There was a man traveling in France before World War II. He came upon an area that was mostly barren. Nothing was growing. And he kind of wandered off the main path and got lost. And he was wondering, where will I stay for the night? He saw a little cabin, and around the cabin were sheep. And as he knocked on the door, this man, maybe in his 50s or so, answered the door. And the man didn't talk very much, but he invited him in, gave him a little something to eat. And the traveler asked the man, "What is your story?" He said, "My wife and my only child died, and I decided to come up here on the mountain and just take care of my sheep and live out my life like this." So then after they finished eating, the man was taking some acorns, you know, oak seeds, and he was sorting them into piles and counting them. But he didn't speak much, and the traveler was just watching, and he said, "Can I stay here a couple days?" And the man said, "Sure." The next day they went out together, and the man took his bag of acorns, and he took a stick, and he was traveling in this barren area, just poking holes and putting in an acorn, and poking holes, and putting in an acorn, and poking holes, and putting in an acorn, like that. And the traveler said, "How long have you been doing this for?" He said, "Oh, about 10 years. He said, "Do you have any results?" And he said, "Yes." And he took him to areas where there were all these oak trees growing. And he explained how he had studied what kind of trees would revitalize a barren area. The traveler was fascinated, and he said he had to go on his way, and then it was World War II. He was fighting in World War II, and he forgot about the man with the oak tree. But then he was traveling again, and he was in the same area, and he thought, "Oh, there's this man planting oak trees. Let me go see what has happened." And he went there, and there was a whole forest, not only of oak, but of beech. And again he found the man, and now he found the man had a new hobby. Instead of keeping sheep, he was keeping bees. And he was planting many different kinds of trees, and he kept the bees to fertilize the trees and the different flowers, and gradually a whole park was growing. And again, the traveler left, and then some years later, he came back, maybe another 10, 15 years later, and he saw a big sign, "Festival today, inauguration of the new park." And the government people were there, and there was a stream flowing, and families were there with their children having a picnic. And there was a whole beautiful park and garden and forest. And he went up to one of the officials and he said, "Where did this park come from?" And they said, "I don't know. Many years ago, this used to be barren, and somehow nature just rejuvenated itself." So again, he searched out the man in the hut. By this time, the man was very old. And having remained isolated from people, he no longer spoke at all. But he showed him all the little seedlings that he was growing. So little by little, we say little drops of water, they wear away stone. And one may think, well, I'm not doing very much, but you plant some seeds. You do something. And Prabhupada said that by our endeavor to chant Hare Krishna, especially by this Harinam Sankirtana, that we can change the whole atmosphere into like that of Satyayuga. And Maharaj was just saying this to me in the car on the way to Harinam, how that really the yugas are determined by collective consciousness. If we change our consciousness, then we can transform the world. And we may think, you know, it's impossible. It is so barren, Kali Yuga. I am one person. But that is possible. What to speak of, we're not just one person. We're a society. Right, now how specifically to do this? How can we do this specifically? First of all, we should think, okay, I'm spending so much time, I have to spend so much time taking care of my body. That cannot be avoided. I have to sleep, I have to eat, I have to take a shower, I have to brush my teeth. Now I have to earn money. But what can I do for Krishna? What can I do for Krishna? Now if you're very, very, very fortunate, then your means of livelihood will also be your service for Krishna. That is the best situation. Where the way you maintain yourself is also something that is furthering the Krishna consciousness of yourself and of others. That is your optimum situation. But if that is not possible, then at least one should also have some occupation that is being done for Krishna. One may have to have his work to maintain himself and his occupation that is done for Krishna. And sometimes, just like in Chopati, who here has been to the Bhaktivedanta Hospital in Chopati? So how did that happen? There were some devotees, they said, this is, we are doctors by occupation. Let us use this occupation to do something permanent, because just curing the body, that's good, we should cure the body. Not that we should leave people ill. But just to cure the body is, again, it's not permanent. You cure the body and the person dies anyway, sooner or later. So they thought, let us do something also permanent. And they thought, we'll have a little clinic and we'll give out some prasadam and we'll give out some books, and it became a whole hospital. Where everyone who comes there gets filled with Krishna consciousness. Many of the patients, many of the doctors and nurses have become devotees. So one might also be intelligent like that. But if we're thinking, well, I'm not sure what I want to do. Maybe some of you already have it very clear. I know exactly what I want to do for Krishna. But if you're not clear what you want to do, so Krishna gives some very nice instructions, and he gives it twice in Bhagavad Gita. He gives it in the third chapter, and then again in the 18th chapter. 18th chapter, as you know, summarizes the rest of the Bhagavad Gita. So in the third chapter, starting with text 30, he says, therefore, O Arjuna, surrendering all your works unto me, with full knowledge of me, without desires for profit, with no claims to proprietorship, and free from lethargy, fight. Those persons who execute their duties according to my injunctions, and who follow this teaching faithfully without envy, become free from the bondage of fruitive actions. But those who, out of envy, disregard these teachings and do not follow them, are to be considered bereft of all knowledge, befooled, and ruined in their endeavors for perfection. Even a man of knowledge acts according to his own nature, for everyone follows the nature he has acquired from the three modes. What can repression accomplish? And then again, as I said in the 18th chapter, Krishna, where he's summarizing the Gita, he makes the same points, practically identical points, starting with text 57. He says, in all activities just depend upon me and work always under my protection. In such devotional service, be fully conscious of me. If you become conscious of me, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditional life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness, but act through false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost. If you do not act according to my direction and do not fight, then you will be falsely directed. By your nature, you will have to be engaged in warfare. Under illusion, you are now declining to act according to my direction, but compelled by the work born of your own nature, you will act all the same, O son of Kunti. So what is Krishna saying? He says we have a nature. We already have a nature born of the three modes. And this can be described, right? Guna and karma. Chaturvanyamayasistam, guna karma vivagishaha. And this varnashram system that Krishna is describing, varna and ashram. So ashram applies primarily to age. When you're young, you are to be a student. Right? When you're a child, you're a student. As you get older, then generally one takes on family responsibilities, then austerities and penances, and then full renunciation and preaching. So that is one set of duties according to nature. So you know, if I'm very young, I'm a student, then I have to do what is my nature to be a student for Krishna. And then we have nature also. One may be an intellectual, academic. One may be engaged in worshiping the deity, teaching others to worship the deity, study, teaching, distribution of charity. One may be a politician, a government person. Wouldn't that be nice if some of you became leaders of tomorrow's government? If the head of the United Kingdom, the head of the United States, the head of India, were all Vaishnavas from Pandavasena? Maharaj was talking about these secret societies, you know. You have your secret Pandavasena society by invitation only. And you'll be the heads of state of the world. So the politicians, the senators, the congressmen, the world leaders, even the mayors, the governors. And then you have those who are farming the land, taking care of the earth, taking care of the animals, taking care of business and craftsmen, entertainers, workers. We each have our own nature. We each have our own nature, and we're going to do some work this afternoon, those of you who want to help discover what is of most importance to us. But we have our nature, and we have to engage that nature in Krishna's service according to Krishna's direction. Then what we do is valuable. We're going to work according to our nature. That cannot be stopped. I was once preaching like this, and one ISKCON leader said, no, don't preach like this. You just tell people they should just do whatever they're told. Yes. I said, well, next time I come here and someone asks me how should I serve, I'll say the temple president says you should do whatever you're told. But Krishna says something a little different in Bhagavad Gita. So yes, we should act according to our nature, according to higher direction, certainly. I told this president, I said, well, the reason I said you should act according to your nature is I thought you were naturally according people, engaging people according to their nature. I thought that was already a given. So, of course, under higher direction. Otherwise, we're acting according to our nature under the mode. Both has to be there. We have to follow the instruction and act according to our nature. Both. Just according to your nature, it's material. So what does this mean, act according to our nature? So Prabhupada said there's three kinds of activities. Ordinary, desired, and emergency. Ordinary, desired, and emergency. Now, this principle of just do what you're told, that's generally emergency category. Nobody showed up to do the arti. Can you come quick? And you do it. Never mind, you're not generally a pujari. You do it. The person who's supposed to do this program just got sick. Can you manage the program? And you're not a manager. But it's an emergency. Can you do it? Say, okay. Of course, Prabhupada says one who is fully Krishna conscious can do anything and everything under the order of the guru. But that's Mamchayo Vyavicharina Bhakti Yogena Sevate Sagunan Samatichaitam Brahma Bhuyaya Kalpate. No more influence of the modes of material nature. Then you can do anything. But even those devotees, they still act apparently under their modes. Apparently. Arjuna was still acting as Kshatriya to set an example and to facilitate the Lord's plan. But that is emergency duties. You shouldn't be doing emergency. Emergency means it's occasional. If you have a 24, do you say also in the UK 24-7? So if you have a 24-7 emergency, there's something wrong. Maharaj was talking about how we have to have our mind engaged. We have to be socially engaged. Emergency means these things are not being taken care of properly. I'm doing someone else's duty. That's okay, as long as it's temporary. Some temporary facility. And then ordinary activities. Ordinary activities should be according to our nature, according to what's most important to us. What are the things that we most value as individuals? We can talk about general values, truthfulness, love of Krishna, obedience. These are general values. Every Aryan, every high-class person should have such values. But each of us have also individual values. Prabhupada said, you'll never find two people who will agree about everything, ever. And don't think in the spiritual world everybody's always agreeing about everything. No, it's not true. So Natan Goswami talks about how Gopal Kumar went to Vaikuntha. I love this story because I love to argue, so I think they still argue in Vaikuntha. That's good. So he goes to Vaikuntha, and he goes to Lord Narayana, and he says, hey, Gopal! And the other members in Vaikuntha, they say, what are you doing? You can't call Lord Narayana Gopal. I mean, I know he incarnates as Gopal, but it's not very respectful. You have to say, hey, Narayana. What is this, hey, Gopal? And then there was another group that said, no, he's also Gopal. There's no problem. You can call him by any of his incarnations. And they had this debate. But I don't think they give trophies for debates. Anyway, they had this debate and the Gopal team won. You know. But the point is there's a difference of opinion. There's a difference of opinion. So we're each going to have our own individual values. And these will make up what is our ordinary activities. Now one should not think that just because they're my ordinary activities according to my own values and according to my own nature, that I'm always going to get sense gratification from them. That's not the case. Just like I very much like taking care of my children, but I never liked changing diapers. Now maybe some people like changing diapers. All obeisances to you. But I did not like changing diapers. And before I was taking care of children, I had been a Sankirtan devotee. And then they had said, and distributing 600 back to Godhead, Urmila, and they gave me a maha plate. But nobody ever said, and changing 10 diapers today. Even my kids didn't thank me. As soon as they could roll over and crawl, you try to change their diaper and they try to crawl away and you have to put one leg over them to hold them down while you... So they weren't even grateful. I really didn't enjoy it. And, you know, when my kid had mumps and I thought he was well and I took him to the Sunday feast, but he wasn't well and he vomited all over the floor and I had to clean up the vomit at the Sunday feast, I didn't enjoy that. I must admit, I really didn't enjoy it. So it's not that all aspects of your service you're going to enjoy. Or some of you like cooking, but you may not like scrubbing the pots. That doesn't mean that everything's going to give you some kind of sense pleasure. That's not what we mean. We don't say, pick something that, like, you know, makes you materially excited and you think you're going to get some kind of material bliss out of it and then do that for Krishna. No. The material happiness will come and go. And then when the material happiness goes, you'll think, oh, I've lost my taste. It wasn't a taste at all. It was just simply some big material. But it means according to your nature. And if you're working according to your nature, then generally, psychologically, physiologically, you're going to have some sense of accomplishment. But it will be real accomplishment. If you were doing that thing like Prabhupada, I was just listening, he said that we are selling back to Godhead, but we're not interested in selling ordinary magazines. So this happened in our Krishna consciousness movement. Right? Shredas Prabhu and Devamrita Swami and Krishna Loka Prabhu and I were discussing this the other day. How it used to be, you know, we started out going out, giving out Srila Prabhupada's books. We weren't even thinking exactly that we were selling Srila Prabhupada's books. We were distributing. We didn't say, I'm going out to sell books. I'm going out to distribute books. And we would collect donations to benefit the person. So they would value the book, so they would get some Agyata Sukriti. And it was so wonderful, such a satisfying experience. And you just speak, if you speak now to Krishna Loka and Shredas Prabhu, they can tell you all these wonderful stories. And you want to get out a book bag and run out into Venice with your book bag. A wonderful, wonderful experience. And then some of the leaders said, well, this is our main means of making money. We could make more money if we didn't sell Bhagavad Gita and Back to Godhead. We'll make more money if we sell flowers and stickers. So it was superficially the same activity. We're going up to people and stopping them. Excuse me. We're getting their attention. We're saying some line. And we're giving them something. And we're taking some money. Externally, it was the same activity. But I tell you, frankly, it was not very satisfying. And after some time, I said, I guess I really don't want to go on Sankirtana anymore. Okay. So whatever you do, if you're doing it without Krishna, it's not satisfying. It will not be satisfying. At the end, you'll say, what do I have? Like sand. Like you're holding a bunch of sand. But the same thing when you do it for Krishna, you'll find it satisfying. And if it's according to your nature, then it will also satisfy your material urges. Now, how does that work exactly? Something like when I saw Prabhupada in 1976, so I was sitting, my oldest son was 1.5 years old, and he was sitting in my lap, and he would be completely quiet for 45 minutes. I could time him. I could take him to any class for 45 minutes. And after 45 minutes, he'd start acting like a little boy. So after 45 minutes, he started wiggling and fidgeting, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't bring anything with me. And some of the devotees had luglus that they were giving to the guests that came to see Srila Prabhupada. So they gave me a luglu to feed him, and I kept feeding him luglus. And that one brahmachari said, if you keep feeding him luglus, he's going to become a householder. Strange philosophies we had back then. But anyway, I kept feeding him these luglus, and so he was quiet. Now, is that how we train children? Do we train children by giving them sweets? Is that our primary method of teaching children, giving them sweets? No. But just to keep him pacified so I could go to the class, I gave him some sweets. So we're not going to satisfy our desires simply by engaging in our propensities. It won't work. We'll become satisfied by pleasing Krishna. We'll only be satisfied by pleasing Krishna. We can do what's perfect for our body and mind. We can have the perfect occupation and we won't be satisfied. That's not how to train and pacify the mind. That is not how to satisfy the soul. But while we're under the mode, while we're restless with the mode, it keeps our mind and body pacified so we can do our real business of pleasing Krishna. That is the point. One should not think by doing this job or getting married or not getting married or living here that I'll be happy. I promise you, it will not make you happy. Getting married will not make you happy. Not getting married will not make you happy. Being a doctor will not make you happy. Being a road worker will not make you happy. None of these things will make you happy. But if you desire to be a road worker, if that's your desire, do it for Krishna, and then the mind will also be a little pacified. You're giving the mind a luglu. Now you just be quiet and let me serve Krishna. The real purification for the mind is service to Krishna. But if we don't do it according to our nature, our mind will have no luglus and it will start screaming. And then we won't be able to do our service. That is the point. If we try to serve according to someone else's nature, my mind will go, this isn't a luglu. It's chutney. Ugh. And then we can't do our service. We can't fix our mind on Krishna. We'll be too disturbed. Therefore, Prabhupada said marriage is to make the mind peaceful. One example. Does that mean when you become married, you're going to become peaceful? It's a luglu for the mind. See, you're the controller. Your wife is under your control. Your children are under your control. And to the wife, your husband is under your control. And then the mind thinks, oh yes, I have this luglu, now I am fine. And then we can serve Krishna. So that is why one has to be engaged according to one's nature. And then there's also desired activities. Now desired activities, that's just fun. That's things that are just fun. Things that we just really like to do. We don't have to do them. Nobody cares really if we do them or not. Nobody's depending on us to do them. But we really like them and we do them for Krishna. So for me, that's the work I do for Bhakti Godhead. That's my dessert. That's my desired activities. For some people, it's growing a garden. They grow some tomatoes. They grow some marigolds. They come and cook for the deities sometimes. And everyone has to have their desired activities. Something that's like their little hobby that they do. It may not be their main work. And when the ordinary activities are too engaging, the desired activities may have to be put aside for some time when there's emergencies. But everyone must have some desired activities. Something I like to do this, let me do it for Krishna. It says one should offer Krishna something that one likes. So the other day, who here has ever eaten fresh figs? Fresh, not dried. Oh, okay. So we had one house we lived in, we were renting only. There were these fig trees in the backyard. So many figs. We had to give away bowls of them. There were so many. And they're so good. So I was at the store about a month ago, and I saw fresh figs. Oh, fresh figs. I got a bunch of fresh figs, and I brought them home. And then I was thinking, this is the problem with teaching Krishna consciousness. Because I had just been studying this So then I was thinking, oh, one is supposed to offer to Krishna something one likes. So of course, I'm always offering my food to Krishna. But I'm thinking, I'm offering this to Krishna and then I get to eat it, you know. I thought, really, I should give it to Krishna just for Krishna to eat it. I should bring these to the temple deities. And then I know I won't get any Mahaprasadam. I'll just be first. So I brought half. But something that we like, something we like, we should give to Krishna. And give Krishna some, you know, like there's different vratas. It says that if you fast from something, then it is that very thing you're supposed to offer to the Brahmins at the end of your fast. You give to others what it is that you would like. And we can say, well, what about surrender? If you're doing what you like and you're acting according to your inclination, what does it mean, surrender? Surrender means I'm not doing this ultimately to please myself. I'm doing this to please Krishna. I'm doing this to make Krishna happy. Material consciousness is I'm trying to make me happy. I'm thinking, what will please me? And spiritual consciousness, I'm thinking, what will please Krishna? Of course, the beauty is that what will please Krishna, like the devotees asked Srila Prabhupada, what would please you the most? And what did Prabhupada say? He said, if you love Krishna. So what makes Krishna the happiest is when we're in Krishna consciousness. When we're nicely engaged in Krishna consciousness, then Krishna becomes very happy. Just like when my children are doing that, when those of you who are parents, when your children become happy in Krishna's service, you become very happy. That is even in Krishna book. When Krishna's playing his flute, so it said that the bamboo trees growing along the riverbanks, they were so happy to see that their descendant was engaged in Krishna's service. And the rivers that give birth to the bamboo, because the plants grow from water. So they were also very happy. Oh, our flute is being engaged in Krishna's service. So someone asked me in the questions and answers the other day, isn't Krishna exploitive? That he's created all of us for his enjoyment. Because in this world, when I want to enjoy somebody, I am exploiting them. I have a feeling of lack. Thomas Merton, let's see if his... Ah, yes it is. It's here. Thomas Merton was a Trappist monk, and the Trappists are also vegetarian. So he wrote this appreciation for Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. He wrote, the Gita can be seen as the main literary support for the great religious civilization of India, the oldest surviving culture in the world. The present translation and commentary is another manifestation of the permanent living importance of the Gita. Swami Bhaktivedanta brings to the West a salutary reminder that our highly activistic and one-sided culture is faced with a crisis that may end in self-destruction because it lacks the inner depth of an authentic metaphysical consciousness. Without such depth, our moral and political protestations are just so much verbiage. So Thomas Merton also wrote that each of us have a God-shaped vacuum in our heart. We have a God-shaped vacuum in our heart. Nothing else can fill it except Krishna. Because Krishna is unlimited, this vacuum is unlimited. Just like Kavi Karnapur describes that when Mother Yasoda was breastfeeding Krishna, the milk on the stove became very disturbed because the milk was sinking. The milk in the spiritual world sinks, you know. So the milk was sinking. Krishna's unlimited. Krishna's belly is unlimited. You know, he showed the whole universe is in his belly. So his belly is unlimited. Mother Yasoda's milk is also unlimited. So Krishna's never going to be finished. And I'm never going to get a chance to serve him. So it started becoming a little disturbed and overboiling. So Krishna's unlimited. Therefore, this vacuum in our heart is unlimited. And I am trying to fill this by exploiting others, by sucking in others, resources from material nature, other living beings. What I call love in this world is really I'm trying to take from you. I'm trying to consume you. But Krishna is not like that, and nor is the pure devotee like that. Krishna says, Suridam Sarvabhutanam. He is the friend. What does that mean? Krishna is full. Krishna is not empty. Krishna is not empty like I am. Om Purnam Adap Purnamidam. He's complete. He's Atmarama, Aptikama. Krishna is complete. He is full and he is dynamic. He's not just full, he's overflowing. He's overflowing. So when we say that Krishna wants to enjoy us, his enjoyment of us is seeing us enjoying. Actually enjoying, not illusory. Suffering with a little, with a sign that says, I'm enjoying when you're suffering. Not that kind of enjoying. So his love is overflowing. He wants to give his love to us. That is his happiness. And the pure devotee is also called Suridam Sarvadehinam. That the pure devotee is full of Krishna. This vacuum is full of Krishna. He's full of Krishna. And he's even in the Bible. David says, my cup, what? You know? Runneth over. My cup is overflowing. One is overflowing and giving. Just simply giving. We have little experience in this world that giving is a kind of receiving. Don't we have this experience? That we feel very satisfied by giving? We can feel more satisfied by giving than by taking? Everybody have this experience? So that is the way that Krishna wants us to be happy, by giving. So how do we make Krishna happy? By becoming a pure lover of Krishna and by helping others to become a pure lover of Krishna. We do everything to please him, then he does everything to please us. Not that we do everything to please him and then we become some exploited slave who has no anything. We may become discouraged looking at this world and thinking everything is useless. Arjuna also felt like that in the Bhagavad Gita. Why bother? He said, if I win this kingdom, it's at the cost of my relatives, I won't even enjoy it. I'll have no one to show my opulence to. And if I lose, I die. Lose, lose, Arjuna said. It's all worthless. Give everything up. That was Arjuna's conclusion. Let me just give everything up. Do nothing. But no, Krishna said, first of all, you cannot do nothing. It will not work. And second of all, yes, materially everything is useless. That is a fact. Materially everything is useless. Ashradaya hutam datam tapas tatam kritam sayat. Asadichukite parta natchat mit pretino iha. Anything. Without faith in Krishna, it is asat. No value. Not even to ourselves. The things we are working for in the material world, we ourselves will not value them. We ourselves will come at a certain point and say, this is useless. Then how is it useful to anyone else? But that doesn't mean everything is useless. Take what we have, take our nature, take our inclinations, take our desires, and Krishnaize them. That is useful. That is useful. That brings real satisfaction, real peace, real knowledge, real advancement to ourselves. And amazingly, it also creates, even in the illusory world, a peaceful, happy, prosperous situation. It spills over even to create something wonderful on the material sphere. So Maharaj gave you an assignment. I'm going to follow in his footsteps. And I was thinking, this is very intelligent, because if I do that, then we can accomplish more in the afternoon session. I'd like to, in the afternoon session, do two things. First, do some, and I should emphasize that all of this is going to be discovery of oneself. This is all going to be self-discovery. No one is going to tell you this is what you should do. It's going to be two exercises. Hopefully, I hope to do two exercises in facilitating some self-discovery. And I was realizing that if you did some work before that session, we could do both of them. The first is to discover our own values, what's of most significance to us. And the second, which I did to some extent with the ladies, is to then take that value and put it into what we call a well-formed plan. Make a specific plan that has a high probability of working out. So first to see what our values are, then to make a specific plan to put those values into action in some service for the Lord. So what you can do is homework. It will save us a lot of time, because this is one of the most time-consuming things that we would do in this workshop at Fun Shop, is that I want you to Remember last night Mars was saying to this person, you know, remember, relive some experience. First relive a negative experience and relive a positive experience. I want each of you, don't do it right now, please. There's no time right now. But do it before we get together at 2:30. Come together in this room at 2:30. Go to some quiet place, sit down for a few minutes, and relive. Don't remember, relive. Sometime when you felt very enthused in Krishna's service. Sometime you felt very enthused, enlivened, happy, satisfied in Krishna's service. And you should relive it as if you are re-experiencing it in the present. As if you're seeing through your own eyes, hearing it through your own ears, as if you're in your body experiencing it at that time. Don't remember it like watching a movie of yourself or some detached way. Different people remember things in different ways. Some people automatically remember things as if they're in their body. Some people automatically remember things like they're watching a movie. And that's a whole science of psychology. But relive it so you can re-experience what it felt like. When you're fully reliving it, then think, how did I feel just before I was enthused, just before I was motivated? That moment before I felt motivated, yes, I want to do this service for Krishna. Yes, this is something exciting that I can do for Krishna. What did you feel right before? And give a name to it. It can be a very vague, general term. Happy, peaceful, I felt friendship, security, whatever it may be. Some general term. And you might go get a number of terms, and you might also relive a number of experiences. And I want you to come to the session with a list, anywhere between, let's say, 8 to 15 things, which you consider to be of high importance to you in any kind of service and vocation. And please have these be very general terms. They should be things like integrity, friendship, peacefulness, very general terms. And no one else has to understand what they mean but you. Okay, and come with this list of general terms. All right? And this is that little exercise is one way that you can discover what those things are. It's 9:03. Where's Sandeep? I was given these questions, which are wonderful questions, but they're not relevant to the topic. What should I do? Answer. Why do we chant? There are many reasons why we chant. Right now, pleasing Krishna and connecting with Krishna is not so easy. I've turned my back from Krishna. I've cut myself off from Krishna. There will be a time I can see Krishna face to face, but right now it's a little difficult. So if I want to say I want to reconnect with Krishna, I want to love Krishna, how am I going to do that? So because Krishna is absolute, he's fully present in his form and he's fully present in his name. So we reconnect with Krishna by serving him in his form as a deity and by serving him in his name. Now, deity worship one cannot do everywhere and anywhere, but connecting with his name we can do everywhere and anywhere. Also, Krishna in the form of his name is in a particular mood. He's in a mood of great mercy. He's in a mood of great giving. So when we connect to him through his name, he very, very easily gives himself to us. And there's many other reasons, but we don't have much time. When we are new and have no taste, why does that happen? What can be done to get a taste? Well, it goes from both sides. First of all, getting a taste is to some extent Krishna's mercy. So one must act in such a way that Krishna wants to give you mercy. In that same book by Thomas Merton, one of his friends asked him, what do you have to do to become a saint? He said, all you have to do is want to be a saint. But you have to exhibit that by your actions. And he was debating with one of his friends, what's more important, working or grace? In other words, our own actions or mercy. And there's one purport in Bhagavad Gita where Prabhupada said, God is not partial. Everything is dependent on our own practice. And then in First Canto Bhagavatam, he said it is not just by the mechanical process of hearing and chanting, but by the mercy of the Lord. And it is our chanting that attracts that mercy. So by doing our actions in Krishna consciousness, we attract Krishna. We tell him, Oh yes, I'm sincere. Krishna is attracted by love. And then he reveals himself to us. That is the taste. The taste is Krishna revealing himself, that here I am in the name, here I am in the prasadam, you know, here I am in the deity, here I am in your service, here I am in the hearts of the devotees. It's Krishna saying, here I am. So why should he say, here I am? Just like we don't give ourselves to someone unless they are nice to us. So we should act in such a way that Krishna wants to show himself to us. So what is that way? Just like I teach government, and also circumstantially I've been involved in some legal matters, so I've had some, spent some time in the court. And it amazes me that sometimes people, when they're accused of a crime, they come to court in ragged, dirty clothes and unwashed hair. I'm thinking, how is a judge going to be favorable to their case? You know, they look like a criminal. So we also, if we want Krishna to be favorable, we have to present ourselves in a way where he's going to want to see us. Therefore, all this purification. No, we come before the deity in clean cloth. That's nice. Nicer is to come with a clean heart. So why would Krishna want to see? I mean, do we want to see people who are in a bad mood and angry? And do we want to see them? Anybody want to see such a person? Do you want to see some dirty, smelly person who's angry and grouchy and selfish and envious and... anybody here want to see? If I say there's some man waiting out there and he needs someone to preach to him, it smells like he hasn't had a bath in 3 years. You know, everybody who's tried to talk to him, he just yells at them and insults them. He's in a really nasty mood. Would anybody like to go preach to him? Anybody volunteer? So why would Krishna want to see? We have to try to make ourselves such that Krishna wants to see us. We have to try to please Krishna. But that is the purpose for these rules and regulations. What is the difference between japa and kirtan, which has more benefit? How can one answer that question? I don't think you can answer that question. The difference, I mean, externally, difference, japa is for one's own benefit, kirtan is for other benefits. Prabhupada said, most important instruction of the spiritual master is to chant 15 rounds, and he said that the safest place in the material world is in kirtan. Not that you want to just chant kirtan all day and not chant your japa, or chant japa all day and not go to the kirtan. The yogi for this age is sankirtana. Maybe someone else has some insight on that. Yes? You have some insight on that? I'm 2 minutes after 9. Where's Sandeep? What is it with the verdict? That's all right? Maybe not, huh? So they should come this afternoon at 2:30. I'm terrible, aren't I? Anything else? Are you going to invite me back some other year, maybe like in 20 years when all these people have graduated from Pandavasena and the new crew won't know what they're getting into, right? Anything else? I think we should probably go take prasadam. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.